Hey, everybody, welcome back. Thanks for joining us as we push on through Genesis and as we continue the Joseph story, the front end of the Joseph story, really. Remember yesterday that Joseph had gotten sideways with his brothers, gotten reprimanded even by his father for talking about his dreams. That is the back set amidst the backdrop of also being the favored one, having a gift, a special coat of some sort. And today we continue that story in what I think is a well-known part of Joseph's story. I don't know if we'll read this all because we are going to try and get through the rest of the chapter. But essentially, we start here, verse 12 of chapter 37. The brothers are sent off to the father's pastures near Shechem, and Israel, that is Jacob, said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flocks? Come, and I'll send you to them." And he said, "Here I am." So Jacob said to him, "Go see if it's well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron. So just right off the bat here as we enter the story, a couple of interesting things. First of all is that the brothers have gone without Joseph. Somehow he seems to have gotten out of going to pasture the flock. He stays at home. Jacob seems perhaps surprised by that. He sends him, but then he says, "Go and bring word back to me," which, if you remember, is kind of what got him in some trouble yesterday. He brought a bad report back. So whether Jacob is kind of saying, spy on him, or whether he's saying, you know, you go watch things and tell me what happens. But it's interesting, Michael. It's interesting that he didn't have to initially go with them to do the work. And it's interesting that in a behind-the-scenes conversation, Jacob says, and, you know, let me know what they're up to.
Yeah, so there's a lot here, Clint. And just to be very brief, know this, geography matters, that the flocks are over by Shechem, which should make you think of the last time that we had an experience at Shechem, which, if you remember that story of Dinah and the her honor being taken and the trickery that involved the brothers going down and destroying really every man in that city, that is the sort of overhanging kind of mood to this story because of its location at Shechem. So we know that this place already has kind of a checkered past. And so as we now look forward towards this idea of Israel sending his prized son to go be with his brothers, who can't even say a single good word to him, Joseph has already, as you said, Clint, gotten in trouble because he's been bringing bad reports. Now he's supposed to go get another report. We already see, we're only a few verses in, we already see how this is all building up to be a massive cataclysmic kind of event. And we see that background hanging over it. We see these elements that have already been teased previous in the story. They're going to come together and it's going to be rather combustive.
And it escalates quickly. If we jump ahead a few verses, verse 18, they saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes the dreamer. Let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say that a wild animal devoured him, and we'll see then what becomes of his dreams." So here we have the plan is hatched. They want to harm their brother. And it's very interesting. If you remember yesterday, if you were with us yesterday, we talked about the way that dreams are woven throughout the rest of this narrative. And here we have it said explicitly, "Here comes the dreamer. We'll kill him, throw him in a pit, then we'll see about his dreams, then we'll see if we bow down to him, then we'll see if the sun and moon bow down to him, we'll see how far this business goes when he's dead in the bottom of a well." And this is, if they've talked about this before, again, it would be fascinating to have some information, some backstory here. The Bible is just hitting the high points, and this is their plan, this is what they plan to do.
Yeah, so once again, the idea of the threat that we talked about yesterday is not a threat here. This is an active plan. And in fact, it's only going to be changed, the idea that it's really only derailed because one of the brothers has misgivings about it. So there's a real existential threat on Joseph's life. Of course, his mother has already died, which means that between himself and Benjamin, these are the only remaining sort of connections to Jacob, or now Israel's favorite, most loved wife. And so this plot is not just bad news. It is bad news, but it's not just that. It's really a kind of existential threat against Israel's only remaining connection towards that love that we've had named. There's a lot at stake here, in other words.
And so continuing here, just the next verse, 21, when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands and said, let's not take his life. Reuben said to them, shed no blood, throw him into one of the pits here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him. He thought he would rescue him out of their hands and restore him to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of the robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him in a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. So these are dried up wells, essentially. Now, remember where we last saw Reuben. Reuben had been with Jacob's concubine. And we find out later that he's going to be cut out of the inheritance for that. So whether this is Reuben acting for what he believes to be good, doing the right thing, or whether Reuben sees a chance to scheme his way back into Jacob's good graces, it's not clear. The text would sort of, in my opinion, lean toward the latter rather than being an affectionate brother. I think this is probably him trying to get back on Jacob's good side. That's a personal opinion. The text doesn't say that outright, but it does have the effect of saving Joseph. Rather than killing him, they throw him in the pit, and it's not clear what they plan to do, but Reuben plans on going to set him free later.
I just want to add, I agree with you. And what would happen to Reuben if he does that? If he delivers the son who was supposed to die in a pit, and before all of the other conspiring brothers, Reuben brings him alive. I mean, that's going to be a very schismatic moment in this already troubled family's history. So I agree. There does seem to be conspiring here. But once again, here we have the dreamer, this thing being named, this idea that he's the one who's seen the future. In a way, Reuben is actually here activating and making that dream possible because of his scheming, his desire to subvert this. We're going to see that, you know, the story is going to take a different path here. And this is actually one step on the road to that accusation or that insult to actually become bore out by the story itself. Dreamer is one of those things that turns when we discover that's exactly who Joseph is. And that's exactly the gift that he's been given.
And there's an interesting kind of callousness to this text. You know, verse 25, they sat down to eat. They looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming, continues on in verse 26. Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hand on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers agreed. When some of the Midianite traders passed by, they drew Jacob out of the well. They sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. So very interesting. Reuben is evidently not a part of this. We'll see in a moment. But Judah now comes on the scene and says, hey, we don't need to kill him. We can still get rid of him, and we can make some money doing it. And then there's this line, you know, for he is our brother. They sit down to eat lunch with this brother in an empty well, in a hole in the ground. They're deciding whether they kill him or not. He says, let's not kill him. He is our brother after all. Let's sell him instead. And this isn't a lighthearted text, but there's almost a kind of humorous aspect to the way this is told. I mean, it is almost so callous that you smile at the way that the author tells a story.
One thing to point out here, you see that they took the coat off of him. That may seem like a small detail, but hold on to it, because that detail is actually going to come up at other pivotal moments in Joseph's life. the removal of clothing signifies a substantial change in his life. So here, the removal of this robe signifies the removal of his favor towards his father. He's being separated from his father's gracious choice and actions, and he's being now sold into a power beyond his own. That may seem insignificant, but that's a theme that we're going to see in future points of the story. So just hold on to that.
Yeah, that's a really good insight. Early next week, you'll see another deceit being fostered upon Joseph that involves having someone take his coat. So, be on the lookout for that. So when Reuben returned, 29, when Reuben returned to the pit, saw Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone. Where can I turn?" Then they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, dipped the robe in blood. They had the long road with sleeves taken to their father, and they said, "We found this. See whether you think it is your son's or not." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him." Joseph is without a doubt torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his garments, put on sackcloth, mourned for his son for many days. All his sons and all his daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. Said, "No, I will go down to Sheol to my son in mourning." Thus his father bewailed him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. So again, you know this story. Some of this is a transition story, how Joseph ends up in Egypt, and so that the story can move on to what happens there. But here we have this profound moment of grief as these brothers deceive their father, a theme we've seen before, deceiving your father. Here they do that, saying that they found the robe. They even, you know, they go so far as to say, "See if you think it's his robe. We found this bloody robe. We're not sure. You take a look at it." And then Jacob is so distraught that he refuses to be comforted. Interesting, all his sons and all his daughters. We've only had one daughter mentioned, but there might be or must be others. And he says, "No, I shall go down to Sheol," in other words, to death, mourning. I will grieve this for the rest of my life, which is certainly true for someone that has lost a child. But it is also for Jacob a sign, a way of saying, there is no comfort. There is no end to this grief. This sadness is my new reality.
Clint, there's a kind of difficult precision of a text like this, because if you remember, it was Jacob himself who, with the help of his mother, used clothing and animal skins to trick his father into getting the blessing. There was a kind of blatant in-your-face deception that he was key to.
Put on his robe.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. And so now, looking down to the next generation, here we have that very same kind of trickery. I mean, it's not the same in exact form, but we have the deception happening. These sons are making up this story. Really, are they even trying that hard? You know, could it be your son's robe, as if they hadn't seen it and been jealous of it? So the reality is, here we have this moment in which the next generation is passing on this same kind of deceptive practice. The question is, what tributary that leads down? In Jacob's case, or now Israel's case, it led to a moment where he went to another land where things went well for him there. And when he returned, and we had that whole climactic scene with his brother Esau, he returned as someone who had been blessed. The question that will now hang over the text from here on out is, what do you do, or what happens to Joseph, who's now a slave? That's certainly not the kind of position that Jacob was ever in. And the fact that he's a slave in a notable, very powerful Egyptian's house also kind of teases that the story ahead has some very substantial, influential kind of capabilities in it. But up to this point, as readers, if we didn't know the end, what we know is that Joseph is in a whole lot of mess, And Israel has now got a whole lot of comeuppance that is very similar to the kind of thing that had happened in his own youth. And the text doesn't moralize it, doesn't say it's good or bad. It just says this is the reality of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. As an older man with children, he is now on the receiving end of what he gave his own father, you know, of deceiving him, of being deceived. Michael, you have your electronic Bible.
Yeah.
See what it tells you about this word bewailed. See, I'm curious about that. And while you check on that, if you don't mind, I will say we'll see this tomorrow. We'll look at another story. But it's fascinating that following this story, the Bible gives us a chapter that doesn't mention Joseph. We're going to have to wait until Monday, or in the text, we'll have to wait until the 39th chapter to get to this Joseph story, which is the Bible's way of sort of hanging it out there and making us wonder what happened to him. This change of direction as we just go to a random story, a completely different set of characters. Not a completely different, we'll know who they are, but it's a change of pace that the effect of which is to leave us thinking, well, what happens to Joseph in Egypt? Are we going to go back to that? Which we will, but not until the next story is told, the next chapter is told, which is an interesting and I think a very climactic way to tell the story. It sort of prolongs the natural information that we want and makes us hang in there to get it.
So here I'll throw this up for you, Clint. Not sure if this will be big enough that you can see, but the glossing is weep, is what they gloss it as here. And call is the Hebrew word.
So cried out or loud yeah. mourning, like that kind of sobbing type.
Yeah, and I don't think that this idea here that we saw, I'm going to keep this up here, mourn for his son many days in verse 34. I don't think that is in any way a symbolic or metaphoric kind of term. I think we're supposed to know and see in this man's reaction that the death of this son has particular significance. Now, the text doesn't, I'm making this up. The text doesn't say that if Reuben had died, that Israel wouldn't have grieved. It doesn't, and I'm not sure that it would mean that, but
we get close to that later in the story.
Yeah, that fair. Yeah, that essentially a version of that gets said. But I mean, here, we have seen characters die, and this particular text is going out of its way to point out the extent of mourning, such that all of the sons and daughters are trying to do the consoling. It's not working. The idea of I'm going to grieve until Sheol, till the end, till the moment which I cease to exist. I mean, clearly what's at play here is a kind of destructive moment that Israel is unable to process. And that is partly possibly why Reuben knows it's such an important thing to avoid, why it may have great gain for him if he, I mean, that's a very negative reading of Reuben possibly, but you know, if he can save his father this grief, I think he rightly intuited that it may have profited him in some meaningful way.
Yeah, I think you have to be a little bit careful poking around behind the scenes in the Bible, treating it like, you know, it was some kind of television drama. But imagine the place, the situation these brothers are in, that they may go from we have to tell him the truth to we can't tell him the truth. As he mourns, as they see him day after day, as that mourning period is prolonged, as he refuses to be comforted, they all know something that he doesn't know. And they have to choose whether to keep that to themselves. I mean, that sort of secrecy, that sort of deception, that sort of sinfulness, the Bible doesn't, it's just not interested in the drama of that per se. But when you stop and think about what's happening in this text, this is ugly, messy, and painful. This is wrong at many levels. And remembering that, I think, may soften our reaction to some of the story
yes.
later. And we'll point out when we think that may be true.
Yeah, that's 100% accurate. My last note here is just to say this is why you don't turn to Genesis when you're doing family counseling, when you're trying to talk about parenting, you're trying to talk about the way in which we try to live out the faith in our closest relationships. Genesis is not a primer on the way in which we practice vulnerability and honesty, and we speak to one another in kindness, right? The characters here are so enfolded in their own deep levels of deception, self-advancement, their own kind of generational sins that get passed from one to the other. It's not a soap opera. It is remarkable that the blessing continues. It's remarkable that this is somehow transmitting from one generation to the next God's willful and committed, faithful determination to keep the thing going on. It's clear that the humans are not doing much to help it. God is the one who's bearing the brunt of this. And, you know, we don't hear a whole lot of judgmentalism from the text itself about what these humans should have been doing or what these characters should have been doing. But what we do know is that they would not be where they are if it's not for the God who stands behind them. Because, Clint, I mean, this is an unsustainable model as you look forward.
Yeah, the Bible assumes that for God to be active in the lives of humans, it will be in the lives of broken and sinful reality of people. That's all the Bible knows. The Bible isn't shocked by human behavior. In fact, it sort of assumes it won't be good. And so it surprises us to see some of these stories, but I think the scripture just says, well, yeah, this is how people act sometimes, and yet God is in the midst of working with them and through them, even in spite of their brokenness. And that will be, again, not to keep saying this, but that will be, I think, particularly right. poignant later on, and we'll have a significant conversation about it near the end of the book.
For anyone who may be broken, that is good news.
It is very good news.
We'll see you tomorrow, friends.